This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to have with me the author of a fascinating and gorgeous new book titled The Globe Makers, The Curious Story of an Ancient Craft, just published in 2023 from Bloomsbury. I have with me Peter Bellerby, who is a globe maker of very, very cool globes. And this book is all about how he came to be a globe maker and a bit about how it's going. So Peter, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. But before we dive into the book's contents itself, could you please introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write a book?
Yeah, so my name is Peter Bellerby, and I set up this, well, kind of going things in slightly the odd way around, but I set up a company in 2010, just after I had decided rather stupidly to try and make my father a globe for his 80th birthday. And it was such a wonderful process, the 2 years of the trial and error and all the fantastic coincidences that happened and the meetings with people that happened, that I always wanted to write some sort of a book, some sort of a pamphlet leaflet to go with all our globes. Just when we send our globes out, we ship all around the world. And so I'm always embarrassed by the fact that we send this little kind of booklet, and it used to be just a postcard with a globe that might have cost thousands of pounds. And so I always wanted to write something that told the whole story of how this all happened. And rather wonderfully, an agent a couple of years ago got in touch with me and said, "I'd love you to write a book." And I just replied, "I would love to write a book." And it's gone from there. It's been an amazing collaboration between both me writing the narrative and my team helping to illustrate the book, as well as we have been photographed so many times over the years. We've got a very aesthetic studio. And so we have photographers come in and take photos. So we included a lot of those in the book as well. Was that short?
No, that was brilliant. Thank you for the introduction. And I think it's very, I'm so glad you highlighted right at the beginning just how aesthetic the book is, right? How photographs and the illustrations, it really is quite a gorgeous book as well.
That was really important for us, that it has to represent the company.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does definitely have a cool story, as well as visually being pretty spectacular. So on the story side, you just briefly mentioned kind of the initial impetus for this, but it is worth going into a bit more detail. Why did you decide to create your own globe?
So like everyone around the world who buys their father a present for his birthday, I've struggled over the years. I bought the usual thing, alcohol, shirts, ties. 1 year I even bought cigars for him, the finest Cuban cigars. He obviously hasn't smoked since his 20s, so didn't take that very kindly. So I thought for his upcoming 80th birthday, I would make a globe for him. I thought it'd be a really fun thing to make. Sorry, I'll take that all back. I thought I'd buy him a globe. So I then went around Stanford's looking for a globe, which is a big store in central London, and other places, Harrods. And I looked around auction houses, and I realized there was nothing that I was drawn to, or that was the modern ones tend to be relatively simple in their design, and the antique ones, every time you spin them, another piece falls. So therefore, I came to the logical conclusion, or not, that I should make my father a globe. And so I set about Making a Globe. It was 2008. I had just finished doing some houses up, and I was about to buy another house. I was doing a little bit of property developing, and 2008 was possibly the worst time in the world to get involved in buying a new house. So I thought I would give it a go to try and make one for my dad, and gave myself 3 months and a few £1,000. And hey presto, 2 years later, and first to £200,000, I had a Globe.
That sounds sort of nice and straightforward and easy, told like that, which of course you detail in the book wasn't quite so straightforward. So can you kind of start us off at the beginning? What was the initial list of tasks and priorities you had for, right, I'm going to build a Globe, here's what I think I need to do? And then how well did that match up to the actual process? What was missing from that initial list?
Well, so obviously I was using slightly stupid English sarcasm there. So I gave myself 3 months and a few £1,000, and it literally took me 2 years and £200,000. So it went way off the scale. So I guess at the beginning, my list was just the main construction things. So I needed to make a sphere. Didn't seem too difficult. I needed to learn how to put the what are called gauze onto a sphere. And obviously that had been done amazingly well in the 17th and 18th centuries. So with modern materials, modern processes, there's no reason why I couldn't do that. I was pretty confident with my hands when I did property developing. I often did a lot of the tasks myself, so I wasn't fazed by that, which was a bit silly. But I had the other processes. I had to find a meridian to circle around the globe, and I had to find a woodworker who would help me make the wooden stands. What I was missing from all of that was the fact that, things were missing is I had no idea until 3 or 4 months in that I was going to turn this into a company. So I didn't even think that once I had turned it into a company, I had to have a PR and marketing strategy. I had to realize that I might be doing interviews. I might be doing photo shoots. I had to be engaged in that and learn how to smile. I had to learn how to, if we were going to market into stores, I had to learn how to get into stores. It's impossible finding buyers in stores. So it was all the kind of commercial side of things. Because I didn't plan this as a business, I just planned it to begin with to make a couple of Globes. And so I was missing a whole host of commercial things that you would have in any normal sort of business plan. Mm.
No, that makes sense, especially as you said, you weren't trying to make a business to begin with. Getting in then to the process of actually making the globe, and before we get to the map bit, there's of course the sphere it has to go on. How difficult is it actually to make a sphere that one can then do other things with?
There are many ways to skin a cat. I wanted to make sure that I did this in the kind of most handmade way. So you can get fiberglass. I was using plaster Paris at the beginning, but we now use fiberglass. But neither one of them, you can get spun and cast into a sphere. But that just takes away any romanticism of the process. So the way I did it at the beginning was just to get two hemispheres and then try and join them together. And both the process of making hemispheres with plaster Paris and the process of extracting the hemisphere from the mold, the finding a mold that is half decent is nigh on impossible. And then trying to cut the edges that you've created at the top of each hemisphere and then join them together. And then obviously balance a globe after you've done all this process. Those are all wonderfully interesting things, engineering challenges, which, to be honest, I loved every bit of it. That's, in a sense, that's why I did this. I thought there might be a few little engineering challenges. I didn't realize that when you are dealing with spheres and circles, you could almost multiply any error by a factor of pi. It just seems that way. Every time something goes wrong, it's like 3.14159.62 whatever times wrong. It's just everything is exacerbated by the fact you are dealing with a sphere. There really is a very good reason why, up until very recently, the vast majority of all buildings around the world have been built straight sides. It's just it's so much simpler.
This is something that, as I was reading the book, I kept sort of imagining, like, not quite spherical balls like rolling around the studio and just sort of escaping you at every turn. And so I wasn't particularly surprised, having got to that point, to kind of read about the enormous number of tools and apparatuses needed to make this actually happen. I was surprised, though, that you've had to create a bunch of them from scratch. Why? And can you introduce us to some of them?
Yeah, it's things like compasses. We have to make gigantic compasses. And the thing that's always a challenge with a compass is the fact that normally when you're on a flat piece of paper, they kind of work. But as you put more pressure on them, they tend to, unless they've got they're very rigid, they tend to slightly drift away from the center as you're spinning them around. And certainly as the angle increases, that gets worse. Well, obviously we're dealing with a sphere, so you're dealing with very acute angles at some stage. So we've had to make gigantic compasses, which often are just arches of metal, which have a point, which neatly goes into either pole, and then we attach a pencil to the point where we want to add the kind of the line that goes around the globe. So when, prior to putting on a gore, we are marking the globe up where the latitude lines are to give us a guide. So that's one thing. But we have so many jigs here. You can imagine most canvases that you paint on are relatively simple. It's a flat canvas. It can either go on the floor or it can go on the wall. So if, for instance, you want to varnish a flat canvas, it's easy. You start at one end and you stop at the other end. If you want to varnish a globe, you have to have a jig that it goes in so none of it touches what it would normally be sitting in. Usually we have all these sort of round objects around the studio that the globes get put in. They have a tendency to roll away. So we have jigs so that the globes can be supported with a rod through the axle so that we can do these processes whereby so that we can add a layer of varnish all in one without having to stop. And we have, with the workshop, we have, I mean, 50 jigs. Every single table we make, every single new design, we have to make jigs to make it work, because there just isn't something built. Even the kind of the basic circular surround that goes around a globe in a traditional stand, you'll be able to see those images of those either in the book or online. That is something that no other manufacturer makes. It's just not, who makes a piece of wood that has a huge hole in the center? So we've had to learn processes, but we've also had to build jigs and arrangements in order to make those work.
Huge amount of work, and we're not even done with the globe creation bit. So moving on from the creation of the sphere to the actual putting the maps on it, where do you get your maps from, and why has this been unexpectedly complicated?
So I licensed our map from just a company that has a great I draw a great online collection of maps in vector form. And what I didn't realize is that a lot of people have just not bothered to update maps because, for whatever reason, I don't know. It's just, I think they had the same lethargy that globe making had for most of the last half of the 20th century, where people would be so bad at making verbs, they would put it, you would lose continents or countries at times because the pieces of paper would just overlap far too far. And so when I got the map originally, I basically stripped it completely back and started from scratch. That was the only way to do it. It's been complicated in this in sense, and perhaps this is kind of slightly leading on to the next question, or a later question, is the fact that we can't just use one map.
Which makes your life inevitably much more difficult. I suppose we can go to that now, actually. Why don't you use just one map? What are some of the existing complexities with maps? Even if everything is updated, there's still a bunch of problems.
Yeah.
Want to tell us about this?
Yeah, politically speaking, that's where the issue is. It is we can't send a globe to China with Taiwan marked. We can't send a globe to a number of Middle Eastern countries with Israel marked. We just don't. In the Chinese case, we will mark Taiwan as Chinese Taipei. We actually have to tell our customers that they need to have it marked like that. They don't. They sometimes imagine that, well, actually, all the Chinese customers who we've spoken to, they don't really see an issue with it being marked as Taiwan. In India, I can go to prison for 6 months if I send a globe to India with the wrong border marks between India and Pakistan. So it's there are a lot of factors to deal with. We had a globe go to Morocco to an American diplomat, and it couldn't have Western Sahara marks because that would offend Moroccan diplomats. So we have to be really careful how we go about things. At the same time, we have to make sure that we're being realistic and truthful. We won't take country names off the globe. If there's the Taiwan Chinese Taipei situation is a disputed situation, so that's easier. But things that are not disputed, we make sure we mark them properly.
Mm. Thank you for taking us through that. I imagine even figuring out what the rules are and what the penalties are was probably a massive task in and of itself. But this in some ways is not a hugely new problem, kind of what's on the map and it not being fully accurate or needing to be updated. One of the pieces of the book that I think is quite fun, especially for our very sort of history nerdy audience, is there you have pieces in the book that kind of talk about the history of maps and globe making more broadly, not just the work that you and your team do, but kind of the intellectual genealogy that led up to it in a way. So asking about one of those sort of pieces, why did some early maps in the United States purposely have incorrect information, purposely have fake towns marked?
Yeah, this was done to protect their copyright. So they realized that some companies were trying to get into the business without having spent the associated amounts of money in creating their mapping. So they were stealing other people's maps. So some map makers would add on fake towns and fake islands to catch people out. But it also goes to a different level as well with the globe that we are, our huge globe we make, which we call the Churchill Globe, which is based on a globe that was made for Churchill and Roosevelt in the war. They were each given one. All the cartographers on that added in their own hometowns. So there'll be a normal format of all towns or cities above 50,000 that are on a map, and then there'll suddenly be these little villages. So it's kind of, and that's the beauty about what we do is we are a printed globe. We're a printed map. But globe making is no different to book publishing. We are actually a publisher. We publish our globes. And so we now printer globes, and globe making used to be manuscript globes, just like manuscript books, all handwritten. And obviously with printing, they can be that much more accurate, but also you can make one or two more of them. Being that we are printing what we're putting on a globe, and being that we do each one in a bespoke way, it allows us to add on detail, for instance, a small town or village that the customer would like, but also we add on illustrations, we add on people's life stories and families' life stories. We have amazing stories of people where their great-great-great grandparents started in Eastern Europe and then moved to Western Europe and then moved to the States and then around the States. And it's a wonderful thing that kind of brings your family history on a piece of artwork in your room.
That is lovely. Thank you for sharing that. If I might sort of ask a little bit about kind of the practical side of creating that sort of customization. In the book, there's some beautiful evidence, obviously, of watercolors as part of the process. And it's discussed as well in terms of how that is possible. Because to be honest, before I read this, I had not really realized that you could use something like watercolors on a spherical object with any sort of precision. So in, you know, building off the previous question about those customizations, would you mind telling us a little bit about the practical side of the illustrations on a globe?
Yeah, well, so obviously the cartography, the main names, the coastline is the printed element. Then all the color is added by hand. So there are two main issues you have here. In any other sort of format, you don't tend to rest your artwork on the floor, as it were, or on something in order to create the other bits of the artwork. So on a flat canvas, you never are in a situation where you have to, where that arises. Whereas with a globe, when you start, you put on one gore, that's fine. Once you got up to about 9 gores, then suddenly you're having to rest the globe on pieces that you've already put on the globe already. So you've got to be really super careful. And that's obviously when you then are adding printer covers onto a sphere, it is a skill that our team have to spend some time getting used to. My head painter now, when she did her first globe, and this was back in June, she's been here 10 years, so 2013, she painted her first globe, and there was an 80 centimeter. Now, normally, these days, our team come in, and they will start with a 12 centimeter, and then they'll go up to 22, and then 36, 50, 65. They don't normally start with the larger ones. Well, Isis started with an 80 centimeter, and she hadn't quite realized the effect of watercolors and the fact that when you had drips of what seemed like clear water running down a globe, it in fact contains tiny little bits of pigment. And so she painted a wonderfully beautiful globe that had all watermarks running down it on either side. So it's something that we've obviously developed a really good process to make sure that doesn't happen, partly down to every single painter having a rag in their, a paper rag in their left hand, but equally being careful with the amount of fluid that you're applying at any one stage.
That makes a lot of sense. Speaking of processes, now that you've given us an idea of kind of how many pieces there are and how delicate and precise they all must be, what role does yoga play in the studio's practice?
So when you are making, and this is something I had to teach myself, I'm not the most patient person. And when I was making to begin with, I was struggling. And it took me good over a year and a half to perfect the process of applying a piece of paper to a sphere. And so in that time, I started taking up yoga, because one of the things I learned is that when you're putting a paper onto a sphere, you're having to wet it first. And it obviously becomes really fragile. And if you move quickly, you will rip it. And so it was a way of teaching myself to move with a little bit more precision and to move in the way, I suppose, in the way yoga is performed. It has elements to it that really helped that. And we have a yoga teacher come in here once, twice a week and teach the team or do yoga practice with the team, because it really is what we're doing requires so much concentration. And you would be amazed if you came into the studio. There are 25 people in the studio, with the exception of the five downstairs in the workshop. The painters and makers are silent. They're usually wearing earphones, but they're silent. And even if they're not wearing earphones, they won't talk to each other, because it requires so much focus to do either one of the jobs that, yeah, I mean, you just, yoga is an ideal thing. I even also do follow Wim Hof with his cold water kind of medicine. So I have freezing cold showers in the morning as well.
Well, if it works, then it very much works. In the book, you obviously talk about, as you've talked with us now, the complexity of building the globes, the physical side, the information as well. But interestingly, there are some challenges that happen after the globe's already been built. After all of those complicated processes are successfully done, there are still some hurdles to navigate. What sorts of things happen then?
So once we have, once we've made the globe and we're, well, it kind of is something that happens earlier, but sometimes it depends on how our conversations happen with the customer. But the most fundamental question that we now always ensure that we ask when someone orders a large globe is, how big are the doors that you're into the room where you plan on putting your globe? We've had situations in the past where people have had to winch a globe up the outside of a 20-story building. We had a Spanish customer who had a wonderful castle, and he wants the globe to go into a specific room where his study was, and he came over here and he saw the globe and he said, 80 centimeter, that's what I want, definitely that size. He phoned home and someone said to him that the door wasn't big enough, but he didn't believe him. So he got home and then he called me up and he said, Peter, the door is 55 centimeters, but don't worry, we're going to knock down the wall. And then we'll wait for your globe to arrive. We'll put the globe in the room and then we'll rebuild the wall. There are things that we have to kind of remind people of when they order.
Well, and I imagine that as well, the kind of support that the globe rests in is bigger than the globe itself as well. So even if the door had been exactly 81 centimeters, that wouldn't have helped.
Yeah, it's obviously with a lot of our stands, they are quite contemporary. So actually some of them are smaller, but yes, you're quite right. With the traditional stands, they are usually bigger than 81 centimeters, bigger than the globe. And that's the thing about a globe, it's very easy to work out whether it's going to go through a space. Most furniture, you can put through smaller or what seem to be smaller spaces because the legs stick out of it and you can kind of go round at an angle. With a globe, it's 80 centimeters, that's it.
No, absolutely. You mentioned right at the beginning, of course, that there are beautiful antique globes still around. There are also kind of some reasonable reasons why people wouldn't necessarily always want those as their sort of only option for a custom sort of globe. In the book, you detail some really fascinating globes, celestial globes and terrestrial globes throughout that you have found particularly interesting. Could you maybe introduce us to one or two globes that you have found most inspirational or most helpful as you've learned how to do all of this?
Yeah, so at the beginning, when I was looking around, I was kind of looking at old globes for inspiration, and I was lucky enough to get in contact with the National Maritime Museum over here, and they have 400 globes in their collection. So I kind of merrily zoomed off there to go and have a look at them. And I looked around the museum and I could only find four or five. So I got in touch with the curators and they told me, yeah, just like with any museum, most of their stock is not on display. So I went to their vaults and I had a look at 400 globes in their vaults, and they are extremely lucky to have a Willem Blauw globe, which is probably one of the most beautiful globes ever made. And it was made in the 1700s. The cartography is wonderful. Everything about it, the fonts are amazing. And it just was a very inspirational globe for me, along with a Coronelli. And Coronelli is an interesting one because we slightly got involved with this in that we were asked by French Museum if we would help to make a reproduction of one, because they still have the original Coronelli plates from 1683. So I went over to Paris and we did the old school intaglio printing using these plates, which is an amazing process to watch. And Coronelli's globes, he made quite a few of them. A lot of them are in Italy and in Europe, and a few in museums over here. But there's a great story, actually. The book isn't quite long enough, the story. There was a big argument between King Louis from France and Coronelli. And so in the end, two different sets of copper plates were made. And these are, the detail on these plates is phenomenal. They must have taken months and months to do each one, because it's just, the detail is so fine. It's essentially engraving on a copper plate, but it's just wonderful detail. So those are the two that I really got the most inspiration out of it. And we kind of use some of their methodology, or certainly the appearance of what methodology might be of painting our globes. I think it's, that for me was one of the most important things, that I wanted to create an accurate globe, and I wanted to create a robust globe, but I also wanted to create a beautiful globe. And that's what I'd just been missing from globe making for decades and decades.
Yeah, that sounds like a really simple combination, but obviously very difficult to find if you've got antique ones that are beautiful but not robust, modern ones that are robust but not beautiful.
Yeah.
Thinking back then on kind of this whole process, obviously writing the book, I imagine, was something of a reflective exercise. And obviously the years of developing all of this. If you look at that overall, what has perhaps been one of the most frustrating skills to learn? But then maybe if you could give us, as a final point, something particularly kind of awe-inspiring or cool, you know, I still can't believe I can do that type thing.
I mean, I had a think about this, and I kind of think it's really the same thing. But while you mentioned the book, it's quite a funny one with the whole book, because I don't write diaries. I assume when most people are writing a book, they do some sort of research. My research was basically my brain. That was, I had to remember everything as it happened, because I literally hadn't written it down, which is very silly of me. But it's because I never really expected any of it to happen. But no, the most frustrating skill was without doubt learning how to gore a globe, learning how to put the pieces of paper onto spherical form. That is incredibly frustrating. And the only reason I think a lot of our team who come in now persevere is because they see other members of the team who are able to do it. But the first 50 days you're doing it, you're just ripping paper over and over again, and you're thinking, how on earth is this possible? So that, without shadow of doubt, is by far the most frustrating. But I said, and again, the most awe-inspiring part of making globe is pushing on that last panel And then you finally change this sphere kind of into your own little world. And that's the point where you finish and you kind of step back every time. It's not a one-off time, because this, you can't just come into work every day and be like, oh, I'm gonna knock out this group today. You can't do that. It's very much a skill that you have to have your A game on you every time you do it. So it's definitely the fact that we now have the six best globe makers in the world in my studio is, for me, by far and away the most awe-inspiring thing I can imagine. When I set out to do this, there was no one on our planet who could teach me how to do it. Literally, there are 7 to 8 billion people on this planet, but no one could teach me how to do the project I was setting myself up to do. Fine, some people can do it in a ham-fisted way or a not very skillful way, but no one has been doing it to a high level for certainly since the 1930s, if not before. And so that, for me, I suppose, I'm often asked, I must be really proud of this, and do I think it's amazing? And I don't, but actually when I think about that one statistic, that kind of makes it sound, to use a very poor word, very cool.
No, absolutely. And I think just that one answer really speaks to the whole title of the book, which, is a reminder to our listeners, is The Globe Makers, The Curious Story of an Ancient Craft, right? That answer even by itself does kind of speaks to all of those words so well. So thank you so much, Peter, for being with us on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.